listening to The Gone Wild Show, a new wildlife-inspired podcast for people that give a damn about the planet. I'm your host, Marlena Moreno, and I'll be taking you into the wild to explore the hottest wild topics from conservation to climate change, sustainability to social good, and meet the scientists, innovators, thought leaders, and other badass changemakers on the front lines of it all. So get ready to get woke and get wild.
The Gone Wild Show.
This is episode 7, Race in America, with Dr. Ricky Pope.
Like our deepest fear is that we're powerful beyond all measure. Mm-hmm. It's our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. And when we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other folks the ability to let their light shine. And so I think for me, that's what Dr. Duncan did for me. And I think that's what I try to do for men and other folks in the community like that. Like if I could drop out of high school and get a PhD like that, whatever those folks are struggling with as it relates to education, like they could, you know, figure it out and I can, you know, help support them and usher them towards their own healing. And so that, I think that poem always comes to mind. We're letting our light shine and that's going to give other folks the freedom to let their light shine.
What's up, everybody? Thanks for checking out another episode of The Gone Wild Show. If this is your first time tuning in, I'm Marlena Moreno, aka Mar. I am a conservation biologist, filmmaker slash content creator, and explorer with a passion for all things wild. As for today's episode, it is a special edition episode, meaning it's going to be a bit different than previous ones. Instead of the show's usual wild-inspired topics, we're going to be exploring some new territory today, race in America. As most of you have heard by now, on May 25th, 2020, George Floyd, a 46-year-old African-American male, died in Minneapolis, Minnesota after Derek Chauvin, a white police officer with the Minneapolis Police Department, pressed his knee on Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes while Floyd laid handcuffed face down on the ground. After graphic video of the event surfaced and began circulating online, demonstrations and protests against racism and police brutality erupted all over the U.S. and even globally. While the majority of them have been peaceful, some have turned more violent, including here in my own hometown of San Diego, California. Now, the details are still being investigated as to who and what is fueling these more violent demonstrations, but seeing this play out, I knew it was really important for me to dedicate this week's episode to gaining more knowledge and understanding about the situation, and specifically the underlying issues fueling it. So I ask Dr. Ricky Pope, a psychologist with extensive experience in multicultural diversity, to sit down with me and shed some light on everything that's transpired this past week, as well as share his experience as an African-American man living in America in order to help me and anyone else out there who not only wants to be informed about racism in this country, but who also wants to feel more empowered to do something about it. As a quick side note, Dr. Pope also happens to be my brother-in-law, so this conversation may feel a bit more raw and personal than others I've had on the show so far. Now, we do cover a lot in this episode, from history lessons to actionable advice on how we can foster more open, engaging, and productive discussions about race, a topic that I know isn't always the easiest to talk about. But before we dive into all of that, you're going to hear about Dr. Pope's personal journey from high school dropout to psychologist, university counselor, and educator as he helps shed light on the African-American experience. I hope this episode is as awakening for you as it was for me recording it. As for all the other usual intro stuff, you guys, like giveaway updates, etc., I'm going to be leaving that for the episode's outro. So without further ado, y'all, please welcome Dr. Ricky Pope to The Gone Wild Show. Hi, Dr. Pope.
What's going on?
I wanted to be like, what up, big bro? But I was like, no, he's a doctor now. I have to be official.
That's funny. That's fine.
Well, yeah, no, thanks for coming over.
Thank you for having me.
I know it's a crazy time and you did this last minute for me, but I think it's a topic that we have to talk about. Like, there's no getting around it. It should be the first thing that we're all talking about this week. So here we are. Okay, so I usually like to start each guest segment by basically just having the guests tell us a little bit more about themselves and how they came to be doing what they do. So if it's cool with you, before we jump into the heart of today's episode, I'd love to start by just maybe taking a couple of minutes to tell us a little bit more about how you went from little Ricky Pope. Is it you're a junior, right?
I am.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so Ricky Pope Jr. to the Dr. Pope sitting across from me today.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, I grew up here in San Diego and did not have aspirations to go to college at all. I think, like, unfortunately, like some African-American, you know, men and boys and males and are just African-Americans in general, like in our society, like, right, like sometimes there's not a focus on education or a belief. Like, I don't think I've ever had a elementary, middle school, or high school teacher that looked like me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my thing was that whole cliche, I want to, you know, play football and make it to the NFL. Like, that's how I'm going to, I need to get a scholarship. I need to get a scholarly, and then I'm going to, you know, make it to the league. Right. And had no desire to go to college for an education. And so I just got lucky. Like, I worked hard and got lucky. Like, I went to community college. I learned about, you know, African-American history and learned about how, you know, my ancestors were not allowed to read books. And then it was just really put education in a different frame. I was like, oh, damn, like, okay, like, I want to, you know, take this knowledge and take these privileges and opportunities that I do have in society and use those. And, you know, and I had some good experiences, and I had a professor I'll never forget at Mesa College. He would like put all these red marks on my paper. Like, it was like a sea of, you know, of red marks. And, but you could revise your paper in his class and then get a better grade. And so I must've wrote some of these papers like 3 and 4 times, you know, because I missed out on so much in, you know, public school, because I was an athlete and, you know, I just didn't do certain things, you know, and all of that. And so, like, really being in the community college gave me a chance to fill in some of those gaps. Mm. And then I started to get into it, and then I transferred to, you know, to San Diego State, and which was not easy because it just felt like this giant campus of people. And so it was navigating that and working full time and trying to party as well.
And I remember you picking up my sister for your first date, and I was like, who is this dude? You came with your music all loud. Yeah, yeah. I was like, you better get her home safe. Yeah, yeah, good, yeah, for, yeah, you. We partied pretty good over,
yeah,
San Diego.
Yeah, we partied. And so, yeah, it just, it happens. And so that might have added to the years that it took me to graduate from there. But, you know, like, kind of rebounding and refocusing on school. Then once I got into criminal justice, it just was like, oh, this is about the system and how the system works. And that makes sense to me. And I need to know this. Wait a minute. So you mean I read all these books and took all these multiple choice tests just to understand that the system is designed for me to fail? Damn it. We were talking about that in a neighborhood, right? Like, it was like this whole, yeah, it was like this whole kind of thing, but it was the right major for me, you know, at the time, just because I remember one class we were watching The Wire, and then we took the concepts, psychological, sociological, criminological concepts, and applied it to that episode. And it was just like fascinating because that, you know, that was a life, like parts of my life and then parts of folks that I've known, you know, their lives, and just kind of like seeing like, oh, damn, like, so people are just writing about this and they're making money and have jobs, write about all this pain and shit I went through. Like, huh, interesting. And so that was that experience. And then like getting into the master's program at SDSU, the community-based block program, that was the chance to put some of those concepts that I learned into practice. It's a counselor education program that's situated in Southeast San Diego, and also has a low fee clinic, which I'll send you resources about, because I imagine folks will need some healing.
That would be great.
And so just being in that program, I was able to see just how much mental health service is needed for myself to kind of heal from some of the injustice and things that I had experienced, and provide that same space for other folks. It was like, right, like the way that I was handled, like with my pain, was handled in this like tender way. Like, I was trained to handle other folks' pain in that way. And that's kind of what I took away from that program. And so it was a really healing experience. And then after that, I was like, well, let's just keep going for more school. And so I ended up applying for PhD programs and ended up in Western Michigan University, Kalamazoo, small town in the Midwest, and just kind of learning about, like, it was a program that's really focused on multiculturalism, social justice, and counseling, and having an opportunity to learn from some really phenomenal faculty. And so that was just a transformative experience. And I've just been blessed to have those experiences.
What was your dissertation focused on again? I'm so sorry, I don't remember.
It was focused on creative expressive arts with young adults in a problem solving court. And so I was really interested in how these youth who had got involved in the criminal justice system could benefit from an intervention designed to help them kind of shift their trajectories. And so, so for me, like, it was like just spot on with like kind of my life and like how I just met the right people at the right time to shift you know, the trajectory of my life, right? Like, it's like, if you're a Black male, like, you're supposed to be better in jail by a certain age or whatever, right? And so, you know, I continue to defy some of these odds, you know, like a single mom, high school dropout, right? Like, that you can take those variables and say, okay, like, I can predict where your life is going to be. Mm-hmm. But, like, somehow, you know, just because there were, you know, professors, white professors, Asian professors, all kind of professors that saw potential in me and really, you know, took the time to invest and nurture me, I was just able to benefit and make it to this point. And so I just try to give that back as a clinician, as a leader in the community, as a mentor to folks, and just kind of have people think aspirationally about who they could be, like, about the possibilities. Like, why not you? Like, I found myself at different points in life, like, well, why not me? Like, it was funny at Mesa there, this guy came back to speak. He was and that's why I always, you know, go back when they ask me to come back, I come back and speak. But he came back. He went from Mesa College, community college, to Oxford.
Great school. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, well, fuck, I guess I can go to San Diego State.
San Diego State's a great school.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love San Diego State. I was Tech for Life. And I was telling people this the other day, like, I'm working in the counseling center there. And so, like, I remember when I got the job, and it's crazy, I got the job, I started there in October of 2019. And then my son was born October 23rd. So I was like, oh man, like, who's this guy? Like, comes to work for a week and then just takes, you know, parent leave. But like, when I came back, like, I realized, like, I had this moment of walking in and I'm just like, damn, this is my dream job. Like, this is all the training, all the experiences, like, all the struggles through education. Like, I've been at every, like, I dropped out of high school. I went to community college. I transferred to SDSU, right? Like, I've worked in the UC system. So it's like all these experiences that I've had, like, this is the perfect job for me to serve college students and to help them maximize their potential. And so it just, like, hit me, like, it was emotional. So, yeah. So I just feel blessed every day to
hashtag blessed.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. No, absolutely. No. Like, yeah.
I know you love it. I know, I can see it. I know you love it. Like, this is your calling.
Yeah. To help young people, like, right when they're about to give up or make some stupid mistake, and to just try to, like, maybe look at it like this, and for them to figure it out and to keep going, like, I'm going to graduate, I'm going to get this degree. And so, like, just to be able to be a part of other people's journeys and their healing and their education, I couldn't imagine not doing this work.
Mm, and the ripple effect that that can have, you know? And it sounds like all of your training and your life experience to have this going on now, I feel like you're really qualified to speak on it, you know, and to help kind of guide maybe people who aren't sure what the next step is to get through it personally, emotionally, but then also band together as a community and move forward, you know, so we can have this more positive ripple effect.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's probably a good place for us to transition into talking about, you know, what is going on in America right now. But maybe before we dive into all that and, like, everything that we're seeing on TV with these nationwide protests and what we need to do in order to move forward, maybe just first walk me through, you know, your thoughts and your feelings when you first witnessed, you know, and or heard about what happened to George Floyd. Maybe take me back to that moment for you.
I guess it's almost unbelievable, like, surreal in one regard. It's kind of like, I didn't want to say it this way, but I'm going to say it. Like 9/11 and seeing the planes crash into the building. And obviously this is one man and one cop, and it's not, you know, the same amount, the magnitude of lives lost and all of that. But it's like, no, that's not going to happen. Like, that's not going to happen. Oh shit, that's happening. Damn. Like, it just violates, like, a sense of humanity. Like, it just, those things aren't supposed to happen. But I know that these things happen. Right. And so you're going back to racial justice. You have a history of lynchings in this country, kind of racialized terrorism. And that's just another form. Like, folks have called this a modern day lynching. And so just this overall context that we're in. So, you know, like, we have COVID going on. So I need to wear gloves. I need to, you know, have my face mask. I need to physically distance myself from others, you know, to protect myself from this virus. But then as a Black person in this society, any interaction with a police officer is potentially a deadly encounter. And so I guess I'm left with this question of, how do I protect myself from that? It's just, I don't know. It's just, like, unbelievable to see that happen. And I know that these things happen and have been happening. Now we just have social media and we have our smartphones that can take video and, you know, upload them. And so now more folks can see this evidence that's happening.
And I mean, we've seen this, mm-hmm. you know, social injustice and what happens with police brutality and the Black community. But is it me
Or does this feel different?
I don't know. I think I would have to say, like, what feels different is that almost immediately, the mayor had what seemed to be a very measured and appropriate response. The police, they were fired immediately, right? So, like, stuff like that doesn't always happen in these cases. So that part felt really different, like a step in the right direction, in a sense. But then I think, like, our national leadership is just unstable. And I think people are on edge, like what I was speaking about, just this overall context that we're in. We have the historic rates of unemployment. We have people getting sick. 100,000 people have died, you know, of COVID-19. And so I think there's a lot of other factors that are going on that I think is just kind of exacerbating this. And then people are at home, right? They're all at home watching, you know, this on social media, watching this on the news. And it's just like, it does something to you. Like, it's like I know that I need to stay at home from work. And I know I need to, you know, not party, not go to the beach. But damn, like seeing this man killed on TV, I gotta do something, even if that risks my life, right? Like, I just gotta go out there and do something. I can't just sit in the house with all of the stuff that I'm feeling and that's going on. And so I think that's why this feels a little bit different than prior police officer involved shootings. I think that this one feels different just because of everything that's going on.
And I don't know much about protesting, but with what's going on with some of them turning violent and riot-like, things that I'm hearing from a lot of like leaders in the African-American community talking about, this is a separate thing. Like, that is not the same people. Like, the people who were protesting peacefully during the day is a very different group than at night. But why do you think that is happening? Why are different, you know, groups of people coming out and changing, you know, the vibe and the narrative? Can you maybe help dissect that part of it a little bit?
Throughout social movements, there's always been agent provocateurs, people that would kind of co-opt movements and shut them down. And so, I mean, and you can, you know, look the information up and it's documented at FBI. And so, like, for example, like what I'm familiar with is the Black Panthers and their like social movement and 10-point party platform. And, you know, their fight for justice and inequality and things. And you had that organization infiltrated by the FBI and, you know, by other actors that want to dismantle the movement because individuals and movements are gaining power and people are paying attention. And so if we can kind of infiltrate this movement and organization, then that's a way of shutting it down. And so those things have happened throughout history, even going back to Marcus Garvey and his movement to take people back to Africa. His organization was infiltrated by Black people that were hired by, you know, by the government to infiltrate and kind of dismantle that movement. And so that happens throughout history over and over and over again. And I think something new is happening. What they're saying is that there's supposedly this group called Antifa.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. Like, do you know much about it?
I don't know much about it, but I guess it's a far left organization. And I think they were there also, what was that, in Charleston when people were protesting there. And they kind of were clashing with the right wing protest. And so, you know, that's a completely different thing. But yeah, like typically with protests, though, it's coordinated, you know, with law enforcement. And, you know, folks organize and have a lawful protest.
Does it not seem like that's what's happening right now?
It seems like there's some of that, but then there's also like the infiltration of potentially, and those facts, I think they're going to unfold, but you're having like agent, like provocateur folks, you're far left, far right, leading folks, like just kind of joining the movement. Like there was I was listening to it on the radio, so I don't know which city it was in, but essentially there were, I believe, two white females and they were spray painting on a Starbucks, Black Lives Matter, to, you know, young African-American female. And she was like, why are you doing that? They're going to blame that on us. Like, don't do that. I don't know if that's just like ignorance in terms of like folks coming to the protest for the first time, or if that was coordinated efforts from some other outside organizations that are trying to make, you know, Black Lives Matters, you know, and their activists and their protesters kind of look bad. But historically, you have these Black Lives Matter movements and these protests that are organized, and they generally are peaceful protests. And so I don't know. So this feels like something new, something additional is going on. I think those facts are going to come out and it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds and how folks make sense of that.
Okay. Black Lives Matter. I want to dive into that. What would you say to somebody who they were like, oh, well, all lives matter, Ricky? Like, what would be your response and what is the right response to that?
Yeah, I think it's an invalidation, right? So like in this particular time period, the way that I think about Black Lives Matter is an assertion, right, that Black Lives Matter, and you need to know about it. And so to respond with All Lives Matter is to kind of like discount, disregard, you know, it's like saying like, hey, like breast cancer, like we're pink, we're going to wear pink this month. It's like, no, all diseases matter, right? It is really invalidating and kind of discounting like what folks are trying to express and say. And so,
I mean, why do you think that people just don't understand that and take it so personally? And I guess maybe even taking a step back, if you were to explain to someone what Black Lives Matter means, taking away the All Lives Matter aspect of it, just like if someone were to be like, well, what does it really mean? Like, what does that represent? How would you put that, like, in layman's term, 2 minutes in an elevator if you had to?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not like a part of the Black Lives Matter organization or anything like that, but just from what I understand about their protests is that it basically is a reclaiming humanity for Black people, right? Like for Black men, Black women, Black trans folks that are disproportionately dying from encounters with police. I don't know. So I think it's like shining the light on these issues that are happening in the Black community and asking folks, because like there's no way that, you know, African-American folks can do it by themselves. Like we need all of people coming together to fix these injustices, these health disparities, like with COVID going on, like, you know, they're the most likely disproportionate amount of African-American folks are dying from COVID, you know, based on their percentage in the population. And so it's like, all of these health disparities, all of these systemic issues that are occurring. And so the assertion that Black lives matters is not to say that other lives don't matter, but it's to say that, hey, like, let's focus on this group of folks that are dying in these really horrific ways, unjustly, and not getting the attention that they deserve. And so that's the most simplistic, clear way that I could say it. And I think like the challenge to white folks, I think, and to all folks in society, really, is we're saying that we want to have a country that's based on equity, justice, fairness. Like if you work hard, you can reap the benefits and have the accoutrements that society has to offer. And I think what Black Lives Matter, civil rights, and other similar kind of protests do is it really has folks confront that idea that America is fair. America's not fair. And you have to really sit with that. And so I think some folks can contend with that and can come to some kind of understanding. It's like, okay, like I gotta do something with my lived experience because it's different than other folks in society. And what is that about? And let's investigate that. And then I think there's another set of people that just double down and deny, right? It's just like, nope, that's not a thing. And so psychologically, we call it cognitive dissonance. And it's when you hold these two competing ideas and then you have to do something to kind of reduce that cognitive dissonance. Mm. And whether that's denying someone else's reality, like doubling down, like it's hard to see myself as a white person. I imagine that it would be hard to see myself as someone that's fair and just and that America, you know, is the shining example of democracy and things for the world. But then here's this ugly history of racism, white supremacy, slavery, like all these, you know, Japanese internment camps, like, right, like the killing of indigenous folks, the breaking of every treaty that was signed by the government, right? Like, it's like all these things in history, but I want to believe in patriotism in America and like, right? And so I got to deal with that. And I think that that's hard for folks to really be able to sit with that. Mm-hmm. But I think doing that work and contending with those things, I think that is the way towards a real human experience. It's rejoining the human family, right? Like when I see things happen at the border, for example, and just like some of the horrendous, like I feel that, like I don't, like I'm not mad at those folks. Like I see that they're just trying to have a better life. And you can feel that, you know, when things happen to women in our society, because there's sexism that exists, if you didn't know.
FYI.
And so like you can feel that. You can feel empathy for that struggle. But like I think if you're wanting to believe America is only one way and that none of this stuff could ever happen, then I think your brain has to work in a way to justify those. Like, it's like seeing Trump and believing that he's going to do a lot of these things to help poor whites across the country. But then seeing that, you know, his administration tried to take away the healthcare that they already had. Right. And so it's like, but no, he's going to do great things for us. Right. Like you can't look at the facts of what this administration is doing and how it's not bettering lives. Right. And so they have to do something with that. And so but folks are still kind of supporting some of his policies. And I don't know if they necessarily make sense to folks that are making, you know, $100,000 or less a year. I don't know how these policies help those folks. And so, you know, I think that's really what's the sad thing about racism and oppression is that it disconnects us from organizing and coming together to have better for everybody, right? It's like, I don't want this group to get ahead of me. So I'm not going to vote in my self-interest, because if I do so, they might get health care. They might get these student loan forgiveness. Like, they might get these benefits and then they'll be on the same level as me, right? But voting that way, it raises, you know, this basic standard of living for everybody, right? Like universal health care, like the ability to afford to go to college, to have, you know, all those benefits. Like, I think that's something that everybody could want and need. But you have a group of folks that vote against their own self-interest, and it's really sad to see.
I mean, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, you have these different groups of people who essentially share some of the same struggles, right? You know, and in this case, you know, we're talking about socioeconomic similarities. Yet, because of racism and because it is so damn ingrained in our society, some people will essentially still choose to vote based on their skin color, even if that means voting against their own livelihood, as long as, I guess, doing so means that they aren't going to be grouped in with people of a different race. And like, I know that's a really general analysis of what I think it is that you're saying, but why do you think it is this way? And why do you think people do that?
You know, it kind of ties back. Like, I just feel like all these conversations always go back to slavery, but they do. And so one of the things that occurred was that when you had enslaved Africans brought to this country in conjunction with enslaved Irish folks, right? Like enslaved white folks, poor whites, and they were working side by side, there were rebellions to where poor whites and enslaved, they would come together and try to fight for their freedom. And the elite, the government at the time was like, I don't know about this, right? Like if we allow these groups to organize and come together, they're gonna be more powerful than us. And so whiteness was invented. Right. Like, and so I'm in the club now. Like, I might not own property. I might not have all the privileges of the rich, elite white landowning males at the time. But at least I'm not like those black folks. Right. And so whiteness becomes invented as a way to divide and conquer folks. And so that's why you have individuals that are voting year after year, you know, against their own self-interest, because they're part of the club. Like, I might not have all the accoutrements in society, but at least I'm still white. I'm not like those people, right? Like, it's a part of the identity. And so, you know, whiteness was invented. Like, it didn't always exist. And so,
what do you mean by that? Explain that.
Yeah. So you had Irish immigrants, German, like all these folks who came, they weren't white. They were Irish and German, Scottish, English, you know, British, like they were fighting amongst themselves over there, right? And they come to America and they become white. Right. And different people become white at different times in society, depending on the particular time and context. So like Irish folks were considered not white at a particular time,
which is crazy. So, I mean, really quick, just to back it up, because I think people probably would want to know this, because that's one question I have right now is, what does white then mean? What is the definition in the manner in which you're speaking of it? Like, what is white?
I think there's multiple ways of contending with whiteness. I think there's actually a subset of studies. So there's whiteness studies that's been invented, like I think in the last 10 or 20 years here, where folks are kind of trying to make sense of what it means to be white. So I would defer to those folks. But for the purpose of our conversation, whiteness is it's a political construct. So like race was created to put people into categories so that they could dole out resources. And so you really like a clear illumination of that is this idea of redlining. So what happened, you know, throughout history is that if you're white and you have a job and you know, all these things, then you can qualify for loans and you can live in certain neighborhoods. But black folks with the same, you know, credit scores and things of that nature couldn't get those loans and couldn't move into those neighborhoods. And so what this one scholar, George Lipsitch, he talks about the possessive investment in whiteness. And so basically what happens is, you know, grandma buys this house, passes it down. And so these transformative assets, generational wealth is accumulated, but the government somewhere down in the history of your family gave you some welfare. Right. Like, I mean, and we don't talk about it that way, but that's what it is. Qualifying for for the GI Bill or different loans throughout history kind of bolstered white folks, and they were able to buy property that accumulated and increased in value where Black folks and other folks of color couldn't buy.
Well, why not?
So it was coordinated efforts between the banks and the government to line off the areas of where people of color could live. And so the property values in certain areas would rise because, you know, the group of folks that live there. Like, everyone wants to live like close to the store, like walk it, like, ooh, we can walk about town. We can, you know, go to our little bars and our restaurants, right? Like, everybody wants to live there. And so if you were Black and you could qualify for those loans to be able to live in that community, you wouldn't get approved. Like, you still wouldn't get approved, whereas like white folks would be approved. And so then they live there 20 years later, you know, they sell the house, goes up $500,000, like, and they pass that wealth down generationally. And so on average, I think, you know, the last statistics I looked, I think it was 10-1 on average in terms of transformational assets. If you're looking at Black to white to Black comparisons that folks have. And so yeah, I mean, that's just one example of how, you know, folks like that, like, I mean, people came back from war, like people fought in these wars, right? And so, you know, there's some benefit about being in the military. And so for Black folks, they came back, you know, after fighting for American independence and freedom, and then they're still dealing with racism in their own country, right? And they don't qualify for the same benefits that white folks would get. And so that does something to your lot in life, and then it affects like your kids and their kids. And that's racism.
I mean, it's crazy because you don't think about it, but I mean, you put it out there and you're like, holy shit, that makes sense. Like, I think that kind of brings us to this idea of like institutionalized or systemic racism, right? And so, I mean, talk to me a little bit more about this idea, because I know you can talk about it from like, you know, an economic aspect. Like, I think you painted a great picture with the loans and the being property owners and investing in other things, but also like, is it like educational? Like, what are some other aspects of that?
So the way I've thought about it, and it's been conceptualized for me, is like that it's a global system of white supremacy. You know, like, I don't know who's your listeners, but yeah, no, it is. And so like, you see it across all these different aspects of society. So you see it in television, film, and media, like the folks that we see. And even if you go like, and so like, it's transported from like, from the US and other Western based countries to countries of color. And it's a mind fuck, right? Like, you look at like Univision, right? And I look at Mexico and I look at the sea of folks and the different beautiful shades of brown. But then when I watch it, I see like people who look white. And so it's like, if you have lighter skin, you are promoted. Like, it's almost a hierarchy based on color in the media, right? And now with streaming media, Netflix, you know, Hulu, all these different kind of things, there's more stories, there's more platforms to tell stories of different folks and stuff. And so I think there's a shift there. And I almost don't like to talk about it because I don't want to jinx it, but it is nice to see stories where you're represented. So there's that sliver. You think about religion, you know, like, for example, African-American folks, you know, we come from the enslaved Africans. They had their different religious traditions, but then we get Jesus, and he's painted in a particular image of whiteness. And so we're like one of the only groups of people that are worshiping an image of God that doesn't look like them, right? And you look at cultures all around the world, they're worshiping images that look like them, that culturally makes sense. And so, I don't know, I'll just leave that one there.
Oh my God, Ricky, I never thought about that. You're right.
Yeah. Education, of course. And so, like, you know, for me, just personally, you don't learn about Black history, or you don't get a true sense of history of like what really happened. And so I'm, you know, sitting on in fourth grade and I'm building, you know, huts for the Plains Indians, and no one's telling you like what really happened. And so maybe at fourth grade, I don't want to know about like the genocide and things that occurred, but it's like you're getting this false sense of reality. And so it's not till college, right, that I learned about enslaved Africans and folks getting their hands chopped off for wanting to learn how to read. And so like, getting that story, it puts education in a completely different perspective. But, you know, I spent my K through 12 being rebellious, not wanting to study, not wanting to go to class. But learning that in college, it was like, damn, like, people died and were sacrificed so that I could be here to learn and to study. And it just made me think differently about like knowledge and information. That's education. Obviously, the criminal justice system and this disproportionate in the way people are sentenced, the way people are policed, mass incarceration. Check out Michelle Alexander's work. That's a really good book about mass incarceration. And so I think if we all can get behind like Black Lives Matter in terms of dealing with police violence, then I think the system gets better for everybody, right? Like white folks get killed by the cops too. It doesn't violate like a sense of injustice in the same way for whatever reason. I don't know why it doesn't, but it's just something about just like this historic, you know, significance of seeing like white folks like unleash racialized terror in Black communities. And so it just really goes back to slavery. Everything goes back to slavery. Mm-hmm. But you had, so it's two ideas. Damn, like I'm going on like multiple tangents. Okay, so.
Get it, Ricky.
You have this concept from mental health people, which was funny. I believe it was Dr. Cartwright. He was a physician and psychiatrist. He came up with this term, drapetomania.
Drapetomania?
Yeah, drapetomania, which is a disorder for slaves who ran away from captivity. It was a medical diagnosis.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, isn't it crazy? And so it shows you how science even can be weaponized, you know, to promote a certain political viewpoint. So they don't want, because that's their money, right? Like that's their property that's running away for freedom. So they need structures like in place to justify and maintain like the system that was created then. And so then you have the Ku Klux Klan that emerges also, and you have the slave catchers. And so these people become policing. And so those are the roots of policing, is enacting control, social control on Black folks and Black bodies. That's where policing emerges from.
I had no idea. And you're right. We don't learn that level in school. It's slavery sprinkled with some, you know, pink sprinkles. And it happened. It was bad. But we've all moved on and we've learned our lesson. Like, that's what you get. You don't get the stuff that makes you think of, holy crap, literally the world that we know of, our society that we live in today, is built on that.
Yeah. It's built on, what is his name? Eric... I'm blanking on his name, but he talks about the primitive surplus. And so what that is two things. It's the land taken from the indigenous Native Americans that were here essentially for free, just taken from them. And so like if the U.S. government or whatever it would have been at that time had to pay for that, right? Like how long does it take to develop this country economically? So just free access to this land essentially, and then free labor from Black folks. And so that bolstered, right, and creates this wealth that America has. Like without those investments, you don't have the wealth and the economic power that America actually is. And so, and what's something that's not often talked about is it was purposeful, like getting the African folks here, because when the colonialists came to the U.S., they tried to enslave Native Americans and they couldn't work the lands and wouldn't do that. Like they knew two things, like, right, they didn't, for whatever reason, folks have suggested that they didn't have like the stamina to kind of do the work that was required, but they also knew the land. So they knew how to escape and how to, you know, get away, and they spoke a common language. Mm. And so, but bringing the Africans here, they knew what they were doing. Like it was purposeful, and the Africans, they knew how to toil the land, how to farm and do all these things. And so like they had skills that were needed in order to bring about this. And so you have the primitive investment, the primitive surplus, and then that gives like white folks leisure to be able to study science and to make art and to do music. But if they had to toil the land and they really had to build the country, there would be no time for, you know, all of the stuff that was happening. And so it really, if you really like pull it apart, you can see like all the different contributions that folks have made, you know, to the society, the blood, sweat, and tears and life that people that was sacrificed.
To allow for some people to live a certain way.
Mm-hmm. And it's crazy, like if you go back and you see like they would call it the mammy figure or the Black mom, and she would, the mammary glands, right? That's where it comes from.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so they would be nursing the white babies, right? They would take care of the kids. They couldn't take care of their own kids because they were taking care of the, right? And so those things happen. And so it's this really interesting relationship that you have between, you know, Black and white folks in particular, that's not really talked about or thoroughly understood, but needs to be like talked about in a real way. I believe if we're gonna move past it and learn how to live in harmony and raise the standard of living for more people.
I would really love to kind of like dissect and really try to understand when you said, well, the only way to really move forward, especially just because of what's going on now, but just in general, like if we're going to really get this right this time, we have to come together and we have to talk and we have to communicate. And that's kind of where it starts, and having this unified, you know, understanding of where we're at and where we need to go. But like, how do you do that when you factor in things like people being uncomfortable talking about race?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that, you know, racism, which I think is just built into the very fiber of our country, is something that's really so hard to talk about. Like, I kind of struggle with this, like this idea, like, do white people know about racism and things, or do they not know? And so I think like there is Peggy McIntosh, and she's done a lot of anti-racism work. She's a white woman, older, and one of her seminal works is The Invisible Knapsack, which he talks about all the privileges that you have in a society based on, you know, whiteness. And so like one of the ones that always stood out to me was Band-Aid. I can find a Band-Aid in my skin tone, right? And that was a privilege, right? So interesting to think about these privileges that folks have. And so what she did, she asked her audience, mostly an all-white audience, it's like a 50-second clip on YouTube. And she asked them, how many of you in this audience would trade places with Black people? And she kind of pauses and scans the room. She asks, like, did y'all hear me? She asks the question again. And she says, if so, stand up. And nobody stands up. And then she says, see, because no one stands up, you know, just the simple fact that you wouldn't trade places with any Black person, like, you know that racism exists. And so I think that folks do have a sense of understanding racism, but just choose not to engage in constructive ways of kind of working with the oppression that exists in our society.
The idea of white privilege, sometimes I think people who, whether they subconsciously or consciously recognize it, play it off like they don't, right? Like they'll do the, oh, well, I have Black friends and whatever it may be. And, oh, I'm colorblind. And do you think that, one, I mean, I'm asking you because I'm wondering if there's studies on it. Is it a matter of they're uncomfortable? They don't want to be offensive, or because they genuinely believe that they're not? And or is it just an excuse because nobody wants to be a racist because it's not good for business? Like, what do you think that boils down to?
I think it was all the above, like final answer. Like, I think it's all of those. And so like in terms of white privilege, it's baked into the society. Like, and so like one of the things that I do when I do the training is I really sit with the students and ask them to think about like, how do we get here? And, you know, some trainings I've had, like, you know, like posters on the wall, and we kind of have like timelines, and you kind of see going back to the 1600s of like, none of us were around to do any of the stuff that's happened. Like, it's none of our fault sitting here in the room. But now that we have like the consciousness and the information about what's happening, what do we do with that information? And so I think that kind of disarms some of that white fragility, right? Like folks don't want to feel like they're bad. Like I think about like during the civil rights, you had the forced busing, and you can find the clips on YouTube and you can see like white moms, like, you know, put together, manicured, like just, you know, just safe looking folks throwing rocks at these buses with Black kids in it. And it's because they felt, you know, that their way of life was under attack and they felt unsafe. And so, right, like it's an opportunity. When you're understanding like racism and you're understanding white supremacy and you're understanding oppression and privilege, it's an opportunity to really listen to all different sides and come to a more humanistic kind of perspective where we all can exist in society. And it's interesting that all this is happening in the context of a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And so you see how we're all interconnected. Right. Like it's like racism has been happening and it's easy to kind of put your head in the sand and like just going about life as normal while all these things are happening where people are being killed and there's police brutality. There's oppression occurring at the border where folks are not being treated fairly. There's like all these issues all over the country that are happening. So I went on a tangent.
No, you said white fragility. And when I was doing research to prep for the episode last night, that was like something I came across and I'd never heard of it. So for maybe somebody who's listening, whether they think they have the condition or not, who, you know, is a white person or a non-Black person of color. How would you, I guess, explain that? And then what are some ways that people who want to be more conscious, like, how can we overcome that?
Well, so the way that I've seen white fragility just kind of play out is I've been in like multicultural classrooms where I've either been a student in the class or I've been the TA or I've been teaching the class myself. And it's when folks are presenting their perspectives about their own lived experience. Like, I'm followed around in the store. Like, that agitates me. Like, I have money. Like, I'm not a thief. And then it's like, oh, okay, like, that really didn't happen. It's for some white folks, I think they can grow up, you know, in the neighborhoods where all the teachers look like them, where they can have interactions with the police that are, you know, okay, well, let me get you home safely. Like, right, like they can, it's a completely different kind of existence. And so, okay, you stole something from the store. Okay, well, let's go talk to your parents about that. And you shouldn't do that again, right? Like, and society kind of works in that way for them. And so when they hear these experiences of Black folks and other folks of color, it's like, wait, what? That's not true, right? And so, because it violates their sense of, like, it violates what they know to be true about the world. And so I think they have to contend, you know, with these other experiences. And so I think when there's hard video evidence that's clear, that's beyond a doubt, I think it does something. It's like, damn, all of what I believed to be, that's not true. Like, the police, Mm-hmm. I got to do something with that. And I got to fit that in. I think that that's the space where people can learn and people can move past the white fragility. Like, you don't, that doesn't have to be a place where you kind of get, where you get stuck. And so I think the first step has to be, you know, education, conversations, you know, is really just being engaged and making room for the possibility that what folks of color are telling you is true. Right. Like, it's like, huh, what if that's true? Then what does that mean? Right. Like, the oppression that folks and people of color face, like, it's dehumanizing because folks are disconnected from the lived experience of everybody else in society. And so kind of like overcoming the white fragility, overcoming like racism, white supremacy is a chance to reclaim their humanity as well.
You're so right. Yeah. And it is hard to put your feet in someone else's shoes. And that when you're talking about something so serious that truly is other people's reality and you'll never understand that any way, shape or form, it is easy to I think just build up this sensor system to not allow things that should impact you.
Yeah, I mean, I think like a part of me feels like you take that risk, right? Like, you deal with the uncomfortableness that, you know, that might be present for you. A part of it, I think, is donating to reputable causes that are kind of doing the work already. Joining organizations like NAACP, ACLU, like joining organizations and getting on their listserv so that you can be aware of issues that are going on. I think a big one is teaching your kids about racism, like having them be in spaces that are representative of society, right? Like going, like being in a school, like if you're in an all white school, I mean, like, I believe that the world is trending, you know, towards this idea of being able to exist as a multicultural person and to be able to work with all different kind of folks. Like, that just seems like where we already are, really, right? And so if you're raising kids in 2020 and they're not being raised to know how to like communicate and be around like folks that are different than them, I think you're doing a disservice to your children. And so I think that's a part of it. And like, if we can kind of start dismantling racism and giving people different life experiences, I think that's one place that it starts. But I think it's easy to just stay in the bubble and kind of do what our parents did or just do, you know, what seems easy. But then we're going to have the same outcomes that we have. And so I think it's really an opportunity, right? Like to have conversations. Like, I think it's unfortunate that folks have to wait all the way until college before they get quote unquote woke. Right. Like, it's just like, yeah, like the opportunities, like, what would that do developmentally to have some of those opportunities, you know, as children, like to be able to see how other folks live and to make friends with folks that look different than you. And right, like, I just seems like that's how our society is. Like, it's just diverse, interconnected, and we have to learn how to live together. And so there's problems that are happening in my community and I need your help to fix those problems, you know, so we need folks to get involved and to understand and to think about, like, I guess what I'm asking for is empathy, really, and understanding and awareness that like folks are struggling, and then engage in some kind of action to make things a little bit better than what they are.
Okay. I love that. Kind of with that in mind, in the big picture question, like as a country, where do we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's people are calling for the conviction, arrest and conviction of all four officers. And I don't know what those charges would be for the other three folks, but they were complicit because they didn't do anything. And so I definitely think that some kind of action needs to be taken. I mean, obviously the Derek Chauvin needs to be arrested, and he's been arrested and convicted, and he needs to be convicted and go to jail.
Is third degree murder enough?
You know, that's like above my pay grade. Like I did have aspirations to go to law school, but it's everything's political, right? And there's a strategy. You don't want to overcharge and you don't want to undercharge. And so I don't know, you know, if that seems appropriate. I guess for me, like based off the history of what I know about cases like this, I was just impressed that the mayor spoke out and said something and that he was arrested the same day. Like, and I shouldn't be impressed by that, but that like just seeing like what happened in, you know, to Ahmaud Arbery, those weren't necessarily officers that did that, but right. Like those men stayed at home for almost 90 days, just chilling before they were arrested. And so, you know, for me, like that is the norm. Right. Like nothing's going to happen. Like this, like what? Like the mayor? Like who's this mayor? Like what reality am I in like that? So I don't know. So I guess I have hope in that regard that community can heal. And then by their ability to heal there in Minneapolis and to have justice, that could be an act of healing, you know, for the rest of the nation. Like they could really lead the way and show us how this could be done differently. Okay. I guess that's my hope.
So it's going to start there. It's going to start with that being dealt with for one of the first times the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think so. And I think that that's going to spark, because all of what happened wasn't because of what happened to George Floyd necessarily. It's all the wounds, the historic wounds that folks have, right? Like, I think we just get real about our policing and about the policies that are implemented across the country. Like, I think that has to be like a step in the right direction in terms of beginning to heal.
So what does that look like for you and me? For people like you and me, you know, young Americans, no matter your race, your color, whatever, if this is something you care about, what is the next step? So it's like obviously understanding how our system works, exposing ourselves to that, you know, finding the time to make that a priority. But then from there, once we have a better understanding of how this is so interconnected and how it is impacting us, even though maybe on the surface it doesn't seem like it, then what?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's engaging in local politics for sure. It's building like coalitions and working with folks that think differently, look differently than you. It's holding our politicians accountable and holding our police accountable, right? Like it's holding our corporations accountable, right? Like it's, you know, like not spending our money at places that don't value the environment, don't value humanity, like, right? Like it's really getting that knowledge out there and giving people different choices and options. None of it's easy. It just sounds like it's easy to say, like, oh, do these four things and everything will be better. But yeah, like it's hard work because people have to work and people are caught up in the rat race. But yeah, when stuff like this happens, it gives us a chance to pause and to really think about like, what kind of society do we want to live in? Like, what kind of society do we want to leave our kids?
Yeah. And you said it sounds easy, right? But it's not, because like actually implementing that into action is effing difficult. So here we are now. And I think we have a little bit of an opening. We have a window, right? So what would you say to a white person or a non-Black person of color who is like, the time is now. I see the importance of the Black Lives Matter movement. I want to overcome this with them right now at this time. What would be your advice, factoring in all the stuff we talked about, where like people are awkward about talking about race and don't want to ruffle too many feathers and white fragility and all that stuff, factoring all that in, what is your advice and how do you want us to help? Like, how do you want us to participate? Like, how can we be most beneficial to what it is that we need to accomplish as a society for people in your community?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing I would say would believe folks of color when they say that oppression is occurring, like to believe them. For example, with Derek Chauvin, the officer that killed George Floyd, he had 16 complaints or 18 complaints.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that, Ricky, when I read that.
18. And then I think two they did something about. And so it's like, okay, like repeatedly the public is saying that this person is unsafe, is not a good actor within the community, someone has to look at that. And when folks are saying that there's unfair policing, we need the white leaders to back us, right? We need those folks with the political power and the economic capital to say, like, okay, like, these are valuable members of society.
First of all, you brought it full circle, but like, if you have a voice and you have a platform, like, be damned if you don't use it for people who are suffering or the betterment of society and doing what's right and standing up for stuff that's what's right. Mm-hmm. But what's a resource for people, any person listening who wants to learn more about this topic and get involved right now? Like, what's something that people could expose themselves to really empower themselves to be a part of the solution?
There's so much, but what comes to mind, I like some stuff that's lighthearted. So like, I really like Trevor Noah, like his show and kind of the way he like talks about issues and he infuses it with comedy. And it's interesting that he brings a like kind of an international perspective because he didn't necessarily mm-hmm. grow up in America.
So yeah, he's South
America. Really yeah. interesting perspective. So I really like his perspective. Also, I would say on you know, if you have access, this is an access thing, but Joe Madison on SiriusXM, he really kind of tackles issues and he does it in a way that kind of pulls in the history of things, but then it's like really focused on action and what people can do. And so you can really get a broad perspective of how Black folks are thinking about what's going on in society. So I really like his show. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates, like all of his work, catches books on Audible. His stuff is good. And he kind of really captures like the historic pieces that we've kind of talked about a little bit and brings them, you know, for folks.
I like this. I'll link all of that in the show notes below. So I'll to get like that from you. Okay. This is kind of, I don't think I prefaced you on this one. So if you can take it any direction you want. What's one memory event or experience in your life? And it can be from childhood, adolescence, adulthood, whatever, that significantly like shifted the trajectory for you and, or just has influenced your career path and you being passionate and doing what you do right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because there's been so many pivotal moments, I guess. And it's like hard to mention one. So
you can mention as many as you want, honey.
I would say my master's training was in this program. It's this historic program that's been operating here in Southern California. There's nothing like it. It trains people to become multiculturally competent counselors. It's through SDSU. It's called the Community-Based Black Program. And so I was lucky enough to be accepted into the program. And I learned lots and I saw clients in the community. Oh, for free. That's a walk-in clinic. Oh, there we go. So it's the Center for Community Engagement. And they offer like low fee services for people in the community. So that would be
amazing. I'll link that. I'll make sure we link that in the notes.
I have resources so I can send those to you. Okay. But so I'm in CBB. I was thinking about going for a PhD program, a doctoral program. And so like there was the APA, Association of American Psychological Association. Oh my gosh. So
too many acronyms.
Okay. Yeah. American Psychological Association. And so I was sitting there, there's $150 on, you know, I'm a little poor student or whatever. I was like, damn, do I want to pay for this conference? Like, and it was here in San Diego. And so I was like, okay, like, fine, I'm just going to do it. Like, maybe I'll meet someone. And of course I did. And so like, I'm walking around, you know, at the convention, that's what San Diego just like means so much to me to be in the city. Cause it's really given me a chance to like change my life and, you know, kind of have opportunities. And so like, I'm walking around the convention center, right? And I'm looking at poster presentations and research and all this. People's like, hey, come check out our poster. And so I'm like talking to these people and they're like, so what are you doing here? And I was like, you know, I was just checking out the research. Maybe I'll meet somebody. Like I'm applying, you know, for schools. You need to meet Dr. Duncan. And so this 6'4" African-American male comes over. He's has a PhD. He's doing what I want to be doing. And I was just like, no way. Like, you couldn't write this stuff. Like, there's no way. And so we're talking and I'm telling him pieces of my story. And he's just like, okay, young man. Like, okay. Like, so you're doing your master's. Okay, well, you know, apply to Kalamazoo. I mean, you know, Washington, Kalamazoo? Where the hell is Kalamazoo at? Like, it snows there in Michigan? Like, I'm from San Diego. I'm not moving to where it snows. And so, like, I meet him, and, you know, that's how I knew about the program, just by taking a chance and going to that conference that day. And so, you know, that allowed me to have the experiences that I've had and to get this training to become a doctor and, you know, to provide healing and therapy for my community and for college students overall. And I love what I'm doing. Like, and all of that wouldn't have been possible without Dr. Duncan, without meeting him and him believing in my potential. And it's funny, the year that my daughter was born, he passed away that same year at 45 of a heart attack on New Year's Eve. And I don't know, he was just a really transformative person in my life that believed in my potential to be a psychologist. And he was outspoken. He was a deacon. He had the most doc students in the department that he was mentoring. And he was also on the board of education. So like, I look at the model of his life, and that's what I want for myself. So I don't know, who knows, maybe one day I'll be in politics doing something and trying to follow his footsteps and provide healing.
You know what I love about that story, Rick, is it's a prime example of how important it is for people to have someone that they can relate to, that looks like them, that they can look up to. And that starts with all the things that you talked about in terms of the actionable, like getting involved with politics, like all of that is why that is so important, because we cannot create that playing field without starting from the bottom up, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I've been mentored by lots of folks. And so, like, I've had white females and Asian American females that have provided me mentorship and saw my potential as well. But yeah, I think that, and not discounting that, because I love them. Please keep mentoring and supporting me. No. I love you all.
You talk about all of your mentors. Like, I know you love everyone.
Yeah, but like, for him, like, I think you're hitting it. Like, it was just like, oh, wow, like, I could do that. Like, right. Like, I could envision myself, like, before, like, this idea of a psychologist, I pictured the guy on the couch smoking the pipe with the elbow patches. Right. And like, and so that's not me. And so, and I think, like, what I'm learning, like, early in my career is, like, especially men, they respond to me, like, they respond to what they see. Like, when they see me, like, they're like, okay, I could do this. Yeah, yeah, he's cool. I could do this. Like, I don't know. Like, I think that they gravitate towards me. And, you know, as men, it's not always easy to talk about mental health. Like, I don't, like, probably I'm guessing some men are scared, given, like, what's going on with the drug. I would assume that men are scared, right? And so, like, being able to say that, I'm scared, right? And being able to say that out loud as men and still feel like men, right? Like it's a thing. And so I think I can provide that space for men. And so that I've learned that, because, like, it's easy to feel like, okay, like, I'm not like all these other psychologists, but that's a good thing, right? Like, and so I'm kind of learning that and seeing that and kind of seeing, like, the role that I could play in the community in terms of being able to provide a space. And you know, it's this cheesy, like, quote, like, our deepest, it's not cheesy. It's powerful, actually. I'm not going to say it's cheesy. It's powerful. It was in, like, Coach Carter, the movie Coach Carter, and he talked about our deepest fear, but it's a poem by Marianne Williamson that was read by Nelson Mandela, and it's often attributed to Nelson Mandela, but it talks about, like, our deepest fears that were powerful beyond all measure. Mm-hmm. It's our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. And when we let our light shine, we unconsciously give other folks the ability to let their light shine. And so I think for me, that's what Dr. Duncan did for me. And I think that's what I try to do for men and other folks in the community, like that. Like, if I could, you know, drop out of high school and get a PhD, like that, whatever those folks are struggling with as it relates to education, like, they could, you know, figure it out, and I can, you know, help support them and usher them towards their own healing. And so that, I think that poem always comes to mind. Okay, like, we're letting our light shine, and that's going to, like, give other folks the freedom to let their light shine.
Rick, thank you.
Yeah, it was good.
Oh, my God, I love it. Yeah, thank you. I love your work.
And I love, like, what you're doing. Like, you make, you know, like, obviously I'm, like, focused on race and trying to live and survive as a Black man. But, yeah, no, like, learning about the environment, like, I'm going to, like, get police violence figured out, and then the planet's going to, like, you know, explode. And it's, like, all that work on racism, and, like, now the environment's messed up, right?
No, well, I think that's why I love the idea of doing this podcast and bringing on people from all walks of life. Because, like, look, at the end of the day, we are only one person. Our time on this earth is short. And I think we all have to kind of go with where our heart and our gut you know, tells us to go. But that doesn't mean just because you are a psychologist, you can't care about the planet and the well-being of that, because I mean, you're a father now too. Like, that has other meanings to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's like, as you know, coming from the conservation, the wildlife world, that does not mean that I don't care about women's rights and you know, inequalities across the globe and seeing what's going on out here in my own backyard. So of course, it's, I think that like, the end of the day, I think for the most part, you want to believe that we're all just out there trying to be good people and be the best version, woke versions, quote unquote, of ourselves. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter like where you're rooted, as long as you're willing to like grow in any direction.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I love about your podcast, because it's like digestible. Like, it's at a level that I can understand when I hear the different speakers, like especially the one about water. I really enjoyed that episode. And so it's just like, okay, these are some tangible things that I can do and just kind of really understand.
I always said from the get-go, I was like, I want my podcast to be something that people who like watch the Kardashians can still enjoy.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I think that that's like a large, they're still on. So I think it's a large
society. Right? And, yeah. And I meant like, you know, but like in a, just a representation of like people who are into more, you know, mainstream stuff. Yeah. I get, if I was to tell you, hey guys, listen to my conservation podcast. Yeah, like most people are going to be like, that sounds effing boring.
Yeah, yeah,
but exactly. I want it to be something where it's like, hey, I'd meet up with Mar for a drink.
Yeah.
If she's going to introduce me to a friend who can teach me some cool stuff, I'm going to listen. Like, that's my vibe.
And I think that you're onto something, because I really feel like that's where this conversation has to go about race. Like, those are the folks that we need to activate. Like, we need the soccer moms. Like, come on, soccer moms. Like, right? Like, we need
get
all
your
these
Starbucks
people.
Girl. Yeah, turn on the episode. Let's just have a conversation.
PSL, pumpkin spice latte. Like, we need those folks too. Like, we need them all. Like, right? We need everybody. So yeah. So it's just really nice to listen.
Thanks, Rick.
No.
Yeah. Way to hype man me at the end. Okay, give me a 5-star review on Apple Podcast, guys. No, I love you. Thank you. We'll do this. Give my niece and nephew a big kiss for me. We'll do it again. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
You know, you're the best. Okay. Thanks, Rick. I will link all that stuff that we talked about today in the show notes. You guys really check out the show notes, because I am going to link a lot of really great resources that Ricky's going to share with me. And I'll make sure we do some digging to provide you guys with stuff. And then, yeah, I will also find a way to make sure I can, you know, make Ricky's work and path accessible. So if someone really, you know, was touched by what you talked about today, they can reach out to you. We'll do a little outro in a bit, you guys. But for now, let's say bye and thank you to Mr. Dr. Ricky Pope.
Yeah, thank you.
And that is going to be it for the guest segment of today's episode, y'all. Thanks so, so much for listening. And special thanks to my big bro, Dr. Ricky Pope, for taking the time to come over and speak with me about this. It is such a complex and multi-layered topic, and I know that we were only able to scratch the surface of it in this episode. But I sincerely hope today's discussion left y'all feeling inspired to keep the conversation going, because that is exactly what this movement needs right now. It needs people of all races and backgrounds to be informed about racism within our country, so that we can stand united as human beings to demand change, to work for change, and to become the change together. I have shared all the resources mentioned in today's episode, plus some other really great information and resources that Dr. Pope wanted me to pass along to y'all, in the show notes on the episode's dedicated webpage at gonewildshow.com/episode7. That's going to be 7, the number, not the word. So if you happen to be listening to this episode on something like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, a lot of those resources and links won't be accessible. So if this is a topic you'd like to learn more about, and or if you're looking for ways to get involved, or if you're in need of community and support during this difficult time, I really encourage you to go and check out the episode's dedicated webpage to access all of that information and those resources. Again, that's going to be gonewildshow.com/episode7, with the number 7, not the word spelled out. Last but not least, you guys, 2 quick shout outs. The first is to at Ashley Villa for being the winner of this week's Gone Wild Show hat giveaway on Instagram. We will be doing another giveaway next week, so be sure to tune in to hear the wild code word that you'll need to win. And last but not least, shout out to my homie Namas for making the show's custom theme music. Be sure to show him some love on Instagram at Namas Hip Hop and give his albums a listen wherever you get your music. Because this episode is already a bit longer than usual, I'm going to go ahead and leave the show's new segment, What's Good and Wild, for next week's episode, so that we can all have today's topic be the one on the top of our minds as we head into the weekend. With that, my friends, thanks again for listening. And as always, stay woke and stay wild.